to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, January 18, 2021. More than 80 people were killed during a weekend intercommunal violence in Darfur.
A big number of armed militia gathered the following day early in the morning and they attacked Pindan camp. And I see no reason for attacking the camp because I don't know if the killer is from the camp or not.
And motorbike taxi operators in South Sudan accuse an association officials of blackmail.
Even if your motorcycle is stolen, they don't defend you. If one has caused an accident and you go to the association for help, they don't help.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Unknown armed men killed more than 80 people and injured at least 160 others in Kerendik refugee camp and other places in Al-Junaynah, the capital of Sudan's West Darfur state on Saturday and Sunday, prompting the governor of the state to declare a state of emergency. Governor Mohamed Abdallah also deployed hundreds of troops across the state to restore calm. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Washington.
The violence in West Darfur state began when a member of the Masalit tribe killed a member of an Arab tribe in the area on Friday. Governor Mohamed Abdullah Duma told South Sudan in Focus from Al-Junaynah that it was a personal dispute and the killer was arrested the same day. Governor Duma says the state public prosecutor opened an investigation into the incident, but on Saturday, armed militiamen from different parts of Darfur planned and launched what appeared to be revenge attacks.
A big number of armed militia gathered the following day early in the morning and they attacked Krindan camp. And I see no reason for attacking the camp because I don't know if the killer is from the camp or not. But even if he is, it is an individual act. But they burned down more than a third of the camp and killed a number of people that we are still counting.
Thousands of IDPs were forced to flee the camp in the wake of the attacks. The United Nations Secretary General's spokesperson said in a statement released on Monday, the Secretary General is deeply concerned about the clashes in West Darfur over the weekend. It said escalating intercommunal violence has resulted in scores of death and injuries, the displacement of nearly 50,000 people, and the destruction of property. The Secretary General called on Sudanese authorities to expend all efforts to de-escalate the situation and bring an end to the fighting, restore law and order, and ensure the protection of civilians. By Sunday evening, the Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors reported 83 deaths and more than 160 injured people. Duma says he expects the death toll to rise. He says the attackers also looted civilian property. The governor says West Darfur State is awash with firearms, machine guns, and heavy artillery, all of which were used during the attacks.
That is why we strongly need to disarm all civilians in this state and not just try to collect firearms on a voluntary basis. That is not going to work. We need to disarm people. There is a frightening number of weapons in the hands of civilians. The Juba peace deal cannot be implemented on the ground unless Darfur is completely disarmed.
The United Nations African Union peacekeeping mission in Darfur, known as UNAMID, and whose task was to protect civilians, began withdrawing from the region at the end of last month as its mandate came to an end. Sudan's Attorney General Tayasir al-Hibir told VOA from Khartoum that his office is sending a team of prosecutors and investigators to West Darfur in order to open criminal cases against the perpetrators of last weekend's violence.
It's a committee I put together from the Office of Prosecution that will go and investigate this incident as crimes, and it is comprised of four prosecutors who are very experienced in criminal investigation. They will find out who perpetrated this violence and what are the reasons behind it.
The Darfur Bar Association released a statement expressing its concern about the deadly attacks in West Darfur State. Saleh Mahmoud is a human rights lawyer and president of the association.
The information coming from there is horrible. More than 100 deaths and lack of medical care. One small hospital in Al-Junaynah is already occupied. There is no service for wounded. People are dying due to bleeding inside the hospitals. Worse than that, I think also the performance of the regular forces was not appropriate.
Mahmoud says a full investigation into the violence must be conducted and all perpetrators should be brought to justice, including members of the regular forces.
There are accusations that the military is also implicated in the commission of killings inside houses and in the streets and children indiscriminately, women, children, elderly people. The absence of the authority, government security institutions, the performance was insignificant since yesterday.
Mahmoud says the delayed response of security forces in the state also contributed to the wide-scale violence that started on Saturday. In October 2020, Sudan's transitional government signed a peace agreement with a number of armed groups from Darfur. The agreement provided for a joint security force comprised of 12,000 members tasked with securing the region of Darfur. The force has yet to be established. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Sudan said Ethiopian jet fighters crossed their border last week in what authorities in Khartoum called, quote, dangerous and unjustified escalation of tension over a disputed area. Sudan says armed Ethiopian gangs backed by the government last week killed at least 8 civilians along the border, while Ethiopia earlier this month accused Sudanese troops of killing many civilians in the area. For VOA News, Naba Mohiadin reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs says Ethiopian military warplanes crossed into Sudanese airspace this week in a dangerous and unjustified escalation of tensions over the disputed Al-Fashaq area. Sudan also says armed Ethiopian gangs backed by the government killed at least 8 civilians in Wad Arud and Aliyah villages along the border. The head of the Sudanese military, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, visited the area and talked to the Sudanese troops guarding the borders. Al-Burhan says Sudan has been patient about this land for so long, for 25 years of offenses and threats and accusations. But everything has a limit. He says Sudan didn't start the conflict, Ethiopia did. And now it's eye for an eye. He says they killed Sudanese women and killed our farmers and burned the lands before. And they claim that it's not Sudanese land and accuse Sudan of entering their lands. Authorities in Sudan's Al-Qadarif state say residents of at least 34 villages near the border have been displaced. Sudan and Ethiopia formed a joint committee in December to resolve the long-standing dispute over Al-Fashaga, located where northwestern Ethiopia meets southeastern Sudan. However, the Ethiopian ambassador in Khartoum has accused the Sudanese military of taking advantage of the war in the Tigray region to seize disputed land. Kelbital Amru called on Sudan's military to withdraw from the border region and stop its military operations.
Very recently, in the first week of November 2020, we witnessed unprecedented military incursion by the Sudan. While the work of the Joint Special Committee was still in progress, and when the Ethiopian National Defense Forces moved to Tigray region on November 4, 2020, for the law enforcement measures, the Sudanese army took the advantage and enters deep inside Ethiopian territory and looted properties, burned camps, detained, attacked, and killed Ethiopians while displacing thousands.
Many Sudanese condemned the ambassador's accusations and called on the military to take wider actions. Security observers think the conflict could have severe ramifications in the region. Military expert Sawar Mikhalid says the recent escalation has very risky security impacts on the residents in the border area and the troops in both sides. Also, the call of the war is threatening large groups of people and tribes, especially in Ethiopia, where these tribes are already witnessing a famine. More than 50,000 Ethiopians recently fled the war in the Tigray region for refugee camps in eastern Sudan. The Sudanese government have moved many of them away from the border, citing the security situation. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
From Khartoum, we move to Juba, where some border operators accused the association of allegedly colluding with police to arrest motorbike drivers and force them to obtain membership ID cards. The head of the association says motorbike drivers must pay a monthly subscription fee. For VOA News, David Monodanga reports from Juba.
Many Boda Boda taxi operators say they don't like being forced to pay a membership fee for identification cards or being forced to buy and wear helmets which cost 3,000 South Sudanese pounds. They are also required by law to wear fluorescent jackets and carry logbooks with them at all times. Juba Boda Boda driver Nelson Loro Lako says he sees little benefit in being a member of the Boda Boda Association. He says it would be better if the association supported Boda Boda drivers in their time of need.
Even if your motorcycle is stolen, they don't defend you. If one has caused an accident and you go to the association for help, they don't help. Yet every month they take 500 South Sudanese pounds. We have the ID too, which we pay 2,700 SSP annually. I want to know the use of the association.
Another Boda Boda driver who prefers to be identified only as Modi accuses the association of taking their money and giving drivers practically nothing in return.
My problem is that the Boda Boda Association are eating our money for nothing. If my motorcycle is stolen, they can't manage to pay us. Even when we cause accident, they can't even treat the patients. We also want the association to help us.
Abraham Jok, chairperson of the South Sudan Boda Boda Association, acknowledges that the Boda Boda Association has no power to regulate the operations of Boda Boda cyclists in the country, nor are there any policies on paper to regulate the Boda Boda business in South Sudan.
A policy is going to be developed and we'll give it to government for approval. The policy is going to be, we are going to introduce a motorcycle riding school. Every Boda Boda rider or every person who ride a motorcycle, whether for commercial or for private use, has to be tested, certified, given a license that proves he is a competent road user.
But Jok insists it is mandatory for commercial motorbike riders to pay monthly subscriptions.
This is not a community association or a student association. This is a business association. It has a regulation. It has a regulation that if you don't have a number plate, you don't go to the road. So the association also must impose that law. And they are making money. They are collecting money from the public. So if they are making money from the public, how come they cannot be told to do ABCD?
Jok says with the dues it collects, the association provides ID cards to drivers, which he says helps police to differentiate them from criminals who sometimes pose as Boda Boda drivers. The ID card costs 2,700 South Sudanese pounds and must be renewed each year. Some Boda Boda drivers claim the association is colluding with police and the Juba City Council to arrest them for not subscribing to the association. But Major General Daniel Justin, spokesperson for the South Sudan National Police Service, says officers work with the Boda Boda Association to ensure that motorbike operators follow the law.
They are to put their house in order by making sure that they adhere to the law, and then as a result, nobody should ask them on the road. The law is very clear about the licensing of the Boda Boda, and then over speeding and all this. We are just regulating the road.
Boda Boda operators also accuse members of the Juba City Council of working with police to force them to buy branded helmets. Boda Boda operators also accuse members of the Juba City Council of working with police to force them to buy branded helmets from a specific company. Peter Loro Polino, chairperson of the Juba City Council Legislative Assembly, staunchly denies the accusation.
The helmet is very helpful for saving of the life.
Yes.
But to be specific for one company, something like that, I don't know about why. Issues like this is not under the City Council. City Council will always give the regulations, the rules, that for the safety of the people, we need the riders of the motorbike. Let them follow the procedure, like putting the mask, wearing the helmet, and all these things.
The Border Border Association says it registered more than 5,100 Border Border drivers in 2020. Thousands of other motorbike taxi operating in Juba do not register with the association. Some private motorcycle owners in Juba accuse the police and security agents connected to the Border Border Association of arresting them and charging them fees, a practice they say must stop. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, an opposition leader in Uganda says he is under house arrest. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
What is the best advice you have ever gotten?
I got an advice from my mom. She encouraged me to work hard. That she told me a very successful woman is a very hardworking woman.
The great one I can remember is the one my father gave to me to study hard. Actually, he was on his, I can say, maybe a deathbed. He was so ill. He had stroke and he was so helpless. He couldn't do anything for me. That was the last day I even saw him. He was like, my son, study hard.
Is from my father. He has always told me that I shouldn't be afraid to learn new things and to take up new challenges, because he said that you're only afraid to take up new challenges when you haven't tried it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Doctors in the Jonglei State Capital Bor say some women are giving birth through cesarean section in the area. The medical director at Bor Civil Hospital says some pregnant women who give birth through cesarean sections have not been seeking prenatal services throughout their pregnancies. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
22-year-old Achola Lingjog delivered her baby boy through C-sections at Bor Hospital 5 days ago. Jog says she was in labor for nearly 4 days before going to the hospital because of the strong traditional beliefs among her family members who wanted her to deliver at home.
The family members thought that the delivery would just be normal and could be handled at home. But it became complicated until I was brought to the hospital. I became anemic. About 30 people were tested, but none had blood that can match mine. Fortunately, my cousin was born and he donated me blood. I thank the doctors for saving my life and my baby.
Some women say they have difficulties accessing maternity services due to last year's floods that have made movement difficult. 27-year-old Sunday James Atim says pregnant women like her find it difficult to walk long distance through floodwaters to the hospitals.
I visited the hospital when I realized that I'm pregnant, but it became difficult for me to visit regularly as required by the doctors because of the flood. I chose to stay home. I went to Juba, but I did not go to the hospital there. I came back yesterday and decided to come today to see the doctor because I'm feeling pain in my stomach.
Bor Hospital Medical Director Dr. Bol Chow says delivering through cesarean section can be risky.
In December, we had so many cases of operations, cesarean sections. So I may say in a week, they may go up to four. Actually, most of our people, those that are brought, are anemic patients. So it became very difficult for us to get the donors. But some passed away, I think three passed away due to anemia. I think our women just ignore it. They don't want to come to the ANC clinics for follow-up. So they come at the last resort or when it has developed, because most of them just prefer to deliver at home. And when there are complications, that's when many run to the hospital. And most of the time, the outcome is not good.
Dr. Chow says out of 350 women who delivered at the hospital in the past 2.5 months, about 20 women delivered through cesarean section. Chow says he understands that most pregnant women in remote parts of the state do not receive regular maternity service due to cultural norms and a lack of transport.
Cesarean section is the last option, that if the patient, really, you try your obstetric maneuvers and it fails, then you offer a cesarean section so that you save the two, the mother and the baby.
William Dengmach, an obstetric specialist working in Borth Hospital maternity ward, says he only performs C-sections when necessary. Dr. Deng says having no blood bank at the hospital complicates matters.
The hospital doesn't have a blood bank. And when we receive these cases, they came in a very critical condition. At time, the major challenge is actually blood. This is the big challenge in this hospital. We have that challenge. We lost two patients because of that.
Dr. Deng says if women regularly go to the hospital for prenatal care throughout their pregnancy, it helps to catch potential concerns earlier and reduces the risk of pregnancy and birth complications. Borth Hospital nurse Daniel Machara Tim says the number of women seeking prenatal services at the antenatal clinic during the flooding dropped significantly. Before the flood, he says the facility used to serve about 70 women a day, but afterward, that number fell to about 30 or so a day. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Borth.
Still on health matters, the Kenyan Medical Research Institute's Wellcome Trust has raised an alarm on a COVID variant different from those in South Africa and Britain. For VOA News, Lenin Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
About 10 investigators from the Kenya Medical Research Institute, or KEMRI, discovered the mutation of the virus responsible for the COVID-19 disease. Charles Agoti, a principal investigator and researcher, says that the variant unique to Kenya was detected in a batch of samples taken from Taita Taveta County, located in the southeastern part of the country.
Our interpretation is that because in this one place in Kenya, we were seeing it representing the majority of the sequenced samples, it does imply that actually it could if it has intrinsic properties to be more transmissible, it could result to increased number of cases locally.
Between June and October of last year, KEMRI sequenced around 205 genomes in the coastal region and further identified around 16 circulating mutations, all of which have so far proven harmless. Agoti says that the variant will not, at this stage, have an impact on the effectiveness of new coronavirus vaccines.
I think it's unlikely. This is just only one change in the about 1,200 amino acids long spike protein. So still, there are very many other bits of the virus which the current vaccines target and can be able to neutralize the virus effectively.
According to the World Health Organization, these variants of concern, which are on the rise in 47 countries in Africa, may impact a person's immune response and need to be investigated further. Rudy Eggers is the WHO representative in Kenya. Eggers says that the mutations are a cause of concern worldwide.
So the vaccines, as far as we can say, will still be effective, so that as far as we can notice at the moment, but this is very early days and we'll have to do more research on that. From the early indications, it seems that the vaccines that are generally available against this virus are still holding and still are protective, but it's possible that actually there will be a decrease in the efficacy of the vaccine.
Brazil, the World Health Organization noted, is one of the countries where a new variant has also been found. Experts at Duke University's Global Health Innovation Center say they fear that the world may need to roll out second-generation vaccines even before first-generation vaccines have been fully introduced. Andrea Taylor is the assistant director at the North Carolina-based center.
So the current slate of COVID vaccines work by targeting the spike protein. However, the Brazil strain, for example, changes the shape of that protein, and our current vaccines may not be as effective against this or future mutations. Unless we can control spread everywhere, we could find ourselves in the position of needing second-generation vaccines before we have even rolled out the first generation.
According to the latest data from the Johns Hopkins University, Africa has around 3 million reported coronavirus cases with a fatality count of 76,000. Johns Hopkins also says more than 99,000 Kenyans are infected and 1,700 people have died. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warns the inequitable distribution of COVID-19 vaccines between rich and poor countries will prolong the global pandemic. Tedros delivered his such warning Monday at the opening of a week-long meeting of the WHO Executive Board. For VOA News, Lisa Schrein reports from Geneva.
WHO Chief Tedros called the development and approval of safe, effective vaccines less than a year after the coronavirus emerged a stunning scientific achievement. However, he warned that hopes of quickly ending the pandemic are in danger. This because the richer countries are buying up and hoarding all the available vaccines, leaving none for the poorer countries.
More than 39 million doses of vaccine have now been administered in at least 49 higher-income countries. Just 25 doses have been given in one lowest-income country. Not 25 million, not 25,000, just 25.
A global initiative, COVAX, was formed 9 months ago to ensure fair and equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines for every country. The organization has managed to secure 2 billion doses from 5 producers, with options to receive more than a billion more doses. But Tedros said plans to start vaccine deliveries in February to many of the world's poorer countries is now at risk. He said he fears a number of high-income countries may backtrack on their promises of equitable distribution.
I need to be blunt. The world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure. And the price of this failure will be paid with lives and livelihoods in the world's poorest countries.
Tedros said he considered this me-first approach self-defeating. He warned rich countries will pay a heavy price in ignoring the needs of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people. These actions, he said, will prolong the pandemic and added that the restrictions needed to contain the virus will increase human and economic suffering. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Starting Friday this week, we will resume airing listeners' comments. Send your brief comments about issues in our news or what is happening in your area. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. I repeat, the number is +1 202 630 8011. We will air your comments every Friday. That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Heart Attack by Radio and Whistle. Hossa, hossa. We've been listening to Radio and Whistle with their song, Heart Attack. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your phones, vehicles and homes. Please remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing and wear a mask when you're in public places. do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
To give me heart, oh my God, I'm in trouble. I'm crazy because me want to. I dream of you on my pillow, but to give me heart attack, oh my God, give me a chance. I take you to the dance, I show you romance.